I disobeyed because I thought it was silly. Only when I came back, they told me we had reason to be afraid. And I believe there were some attempts to lure me to the yacht, which was run by the Polish Boy Scouts. And they were inviting me there, which I politely declined. But the main way, really, of destroying was through the forging of documents, mainly, and very clever. It was so-called covert operation. Yeah. And this was on a big scale, really. Mm-hmm. It was on a big scale. And I was not the only target. Cardinal Wyszyński was the target. Some bishops, some priests, opposition people.
Well, let me ask you.
Yeah.
Because we're ready. Let me ask you what capacity you were working in that made you a good candidate to be an advisor on Polish affairs for the American administration?
Well, two. First was that I was really top expert on Poland. As a former director of the Polish service of Radio Free Europe, my radio set was tuned on one wavelength only, and that was Poland. And that was for years. So I was considered to be really the expert who knows very well developments in Poland. And the second was that Brzeziński was a personal friend of mine since he was 25. And he simply thought that I would be useful. And three, that I really didn't ask for anything for my services, really. I was financially pretty independent and could really work and offer my work and my advice without asking for any kind of permanent job or money. So this is how I established myself.
What did the American administration specifically want you to do for them regarding the situation in Poland in the late 70s, early 80s?
Well, at that time, I was myself very interested in two instruments. One was radios and sending printed materials, in other words, books, periodicals, into Poland, because I felt that to protect independence of mind is a key, strategic key to the future. And the second thing was I came here with the idea of creating Institute for Human Rights. Brzeziński came with this idea, defense of human rights, which came from Helsinki, final act. And I thought that this was something that has a future and could be used as a kind of ideological weapon which would rally people around the ideological goal, which was defense of human rights, and that happened. Now, I lost my bid for Institute of Human Rights. It was rejected by the Congress. Congressman Fasser was my main ally. And then it was revived at the time of Reagan, and I at that time prepared a memo on Randung, which was, I think, played some role. And I talked to Undersecretary of State Stessel, who was formerly ambassador in Poland, knew very well who I was. And I developed again this idea. And then National Endowment for Democracy was created. And that this played a great role in the time of solidarity.
What specifically did you do to assist and aid solidarity?
Well, I was in touch with many people, many people who were visiting here, and I was simply fighting for funds and for any kind of assistance, both moral and financial. I knew that without financial assistance, solidarity after martial law will not survive. But the main thing was correct policy, some kind of the right kind of support. And I think that, frankly, the Americans were very responsive to some constructive ideas. And as a whole, I must say that the U.S. policy was a contributing factor. It was not a decisive factor. Decisions were taken by people in Poland. But without Americans providing ammunition in the sense of support, moral support, radius, and funds, I doubt very much if Solidarity would have survived.
What were the avenues of money? Where did they come from, the sources, and who was supplying? There was both the CIA and the line that you were also.
Money was openly allocated by the Congress.
Let me ask you to start that again, because my question cut across you.
The money for Solidarity was approved by the Congress. It was open. There was a lot of money, and most of it was going to AFL-CIO. Lane Kirkland played tremendous role here on this side. And AFL-CIO was simply sending money through the representative of Solidarity who was in Brussels. And this was done through their own ways and means. And the role of AFL-CIO would end at the moment the money would be collected by the representative of Solidarity in the West. They have their office in Brussels. Then there was some money was going through the NED, National Endowment for Democracy. And here I was very deeply involved. For instance, there was a problem of supporting a church organization which was giving money to families of people in jail and providing the people in jail with parcels. And I was the one who arranged this through a priest in Paris, so that he got, I believe, $100,000. And the source was NED. So a lot of money was going directly from NED. And there were, of course, I guess, that CIA was also getting money and offering it through intermediaries without any strings. Oh, the only thing they were interested was that money does reach proper people in Poland. And they were not even interested in names. But it was simply money to help finance in Poland, it was a drugi obieg. In other words, illegal press, illegal publication, illegal radios, to maintain an independent Solidarity media. And I guess that a lot of money was coming from through CIA, which was acting as intermediary in this case.
Why were they so interested in ensuring the survival of Solidarity?
Well, because they realized that... I have to do it differently. There was a considerable American interest in maintaining Solidarity because the doctrine was a gradual expansion of liberty. Process, non-violent process, which would expand and enlarge the margin of freedom. And this was the first independent trade union organization which was at least accepted or tolerated by the communist regime. And it was believed that if Solidarity would survive, the other countries will follow, and that the Solidarity will be a major factor in this process of gradual expansion of freedom, which was the idea pursued since 1956, since the defeat of the Hungarian uprising, that one should do all one can to keep the society open in order to maintain the flow of ideas by broadcasting and by books, by newspapers, every way, and also by cultural exchanges. So it was two-track policy. One track was radios and something that was not controlled by the government. And the other was cultural exchanges, which was a negotiated arrangement with the communist regime. And the Solidarity was a turning point in all this core and everything that preceded it. The recipients in Poland that never knew really where the money was coming from. Mostly they were not.
Where then does the liaison or the conversations, the dialogue with the Vatican and Pope John Paul II come into the scheme and plans about how to assist Solidarity?
As far as I know, the Americans were informing the Vatican, at least in time. It was, I know because I was a witness, that it was done when there was a danger of Soviet invasion in December 1980. That I know that Brzezinski at that time was in direct contact with the Pope, whom he knew, and was simply passing on to him information and recommendation, and the Pope was just listening. But I'm sure that he was taking some action, but I cannot say for certain what action and how. This I don't know. And then, at the time of Reagan, the prestige of the Pope here was very high, and I know that the President himself gave instructions that the Pope, that all the information the Americans did have about developments inside Poland should be shared with the Vatican. But as far as I know the Vatican, they were simply listening. And if they were taking any action, they were not informing Americans what kind of action.
Now, the way in which Mr. Brzezinski actually got in touch with the Pope actually came through you initially, didn't it?
I remember that in these very critical times, the first days of December 1980, when the White House had confirmation by satellite reconnaissance of information coming from a defector, or rather from their agent they had inside the general staff, that in a matter of hours or days, Soviets and Czechs, Czechoslovaks and Germans will invade Poland. I had a call from Zbigniew Brzeziński, who said, do you know by any chance the telephone number of Father Dziwisz? Father Dziwisz was a chaplain of the Pope. And I said, I have. May I ask why you need it? He said, well, the reason is that according to the protocol, only head of the state can call the Pope. And since Carter does not know the Pope, and I know him intimately, I would like to call to have a conversation with the Pope. I am not allowed to call directly the head of the state. And, of course, I gave him the telephone number of Dziwisz, of the chaplain, and as a result, it was the Pope who telephoned Brzeziński. And only later, Brzeziński told me, what a history. Here is an American advisor to the President of the United States, who is Polish, talking in Polish with the head of the Catholic Church about the problems of Poland. That's how it happened.
And there was a response that you came to learn to know of from the Pope. Are you able to at least describe, through the information you had, what the response from Pope John Paul II was to the approach made by Mr. Brzezinski?
I do not know how the Pope reacted by telephone to Brzezinski. You have to ask Brzezinski. But from my own experience, I know that Pope is listening very attentively, but he's very careful in telling anybody what he's going to do. I know that in my own experience, that when I was talking to somebody who was close to the Pope, the answer was always, leave it to the Pope, give the information, don't ask what the Pope is going to do. I'm sure that this was the same way.
What could John Paul II have done in his capacity in response to the information he received from Mr. Brzezinski about an imminent Soviet invasion?
This is my guess, of course. I think that he could, of course, through the Secretariat of State, alert Papal Nuncios all over the world, who would use his influence to support United States' request for a collective action. But this is my guess. I cannot tell you that I know he did it. He definitely could, and this was a normal way, to alert through his own network of Papa Nuncios and ask that all the influence should be used on the governments to do anything they could to prevent it from happening, to warn. This is what I guess he could do.
Now, what is the difference between the way in which the Americans must have been aware of, the way in which John Paul II would approach an issue concerning a struggle, a resistance movement within Eastern Europe, versus the way in which the previous Pope, Paul VI, would have approached the Ostpolitik?
I knew Paul VI, and I knew pretty well Casaroli. As a director of the Polish Service of Radio Free Europe, our radio and I myself were considered by the Church as a very important ally. We were supporting the Church. We were really the only mass media, other than the Vatican Radio, which the Church could use in a sense of broadcasting encyclicals, broadcasting anything that the Church was doing in Poland. Cardinal Wyszyński had no possibility to broadcast or to make any kind of radio, but we were always on our own broadcasting it. So I was considered, both I and our priest, who was the editor of the religious broadcast, Father Kiszke, we were considered persona gratissima in both in the Vatican and by the both cardinals. Of course, for security reasons, I rarely talked to Cardinal Wyszyński, very rarely. And I did not talk at this time with Cardinal Wojtyła. Father Kiszke was. He talked to him in Vatican, in the apartment of Monsignor Descour, who was a very close personal friend and I think a schoolmate of the Pope. So Father Kiszke talked to Wojtyła, but there was an elderly lady from Paris, Maria Winowska, who was a confidant of both, and she was also in close touch with the chaplain of Paul VI. So whenever I did want to see Casaroli, I was received, and he would give me a lot of time. So I know from my experience that there was a total difference of approach between Paul VI and the Cardinal Wyszyński and Cardinal Wojtyła. And I had an interesting experience because I received from Catholics in Belarusia an extremely interesting materials, very moving, about the activities of the underground church in Belarusia. Documents, stories, which were very, very moving, with a request that I should give the message to the Vatican that, and I don't know how to translate it because I know the Bible in Polish, but St. Matthew saying the harvest is plenty, but there is a shortage of harvesters. And that the message was that the Holy See should not rely exclusively on the legal church, because the legal church is under total control of the regime, which is using this legal church very often in its fight against the church, but that they should also support underground church. And the reasoning was that the Soviets tolerate legal church only for one reason: to prevent underground church activities. They know that if they suppress completely the illegal church, then the underground church will be also eliminated. So the message was that the Pope should appoint secretly bishops and not simply accept the bishops nominated by the Soviets. And I brought this message to Casaroli. But before I did it, through Mrs. Winowska, I asked both cardinals, who happened to be in Rome, if I can do it, so that I am not at any kind of cross purpose with them. And the answer was, do it, but we have done it many times before. God bless you. And I had a fascinating discussion with Casaroli. And I explained to him all this. I mean, he said, Mr. Novak, stop it. I mean, we did try it under Pius XII, and it didn't work. All the bishops that we appointed were arrested, sent to concentration camps. These people say that the underground church is not under the Soviet control, but they are not under our control either. And they tend, they are people of good faith, but being in no touch, no contact with Rome, they tend to be sectarian, become sectarian. They may be deviations. So they are out of control of both Soviets and us. The line is, we have to save what we can. And we can save it only by a dialogue with the governments, not by the illegal dialogues with the underground. And I told him, Your Excellency, he was a bishop at that time, permit me to disagree. I mean, I think you are fascinated by the material power of the church. Here we are in this beautiful castle of the Vatican, in this powerful basilica, but we forget how the church was born. You have to think about these people in Belorussia in the same terms as we think about the first Christians. They are first Christians. It was a small sect, and they were. Acting in the same way. They were illegal, they were persecuted, and after all, the church grew up of it. And if you want to approach really this, you have to use the terms of reference of the first Christians. He disagreed. And then I told about it. Mrs. Winowska, who reported it to Cardinal Wojtyła. And she came back to me, said, the cardinal said, Jan was right, Casaroli was wrong. So I thought that when he became the Pope, that because the activities of the Polish Church were just the opposite of what the Vatican was doing. Namely, they were doing everything they could to support from Poland illegal church, particularly in these areas bordering with Poland. They were sending priests, also in a clandestine way. They were sending books. They were sending everything they could. And this was a support for the underground church. So I thought that Casaroli would be fired immediately. But the Pope respects the loyalty, and he was there for some time. But I know that this official of the Vatican, who knew how to control himself, could not really control his feelings about this new policy, and was sharing his criticism about this new policy of the Pope in the first year of the pontificate with some outsiders. And I know it because the outsiders told me that he was critical. Anyway, finally, he had left. But I know that the Pope is always pursuing double-track policy. The dialogue with the governments and direct influence on the faithful. And government cannot control his dialogue with the people. And this was, the Pope is not a political man. He is really the priest who believes in preaching gospel. And I don't believe that it was his strategical objective to abolish communism. But he did it as a result of his action, as a result of the fact that his election made people immensely proud, integrated them, and raised the prestige of the church and power of the church in Poland considerably. And then in his pilgrimage to Poland, the first one, he integrated the entire society, and they could count themselves. They saw this tremendous crowds, millions of people together, chanting together, praying together, united by this one man who integrated the entire society and gave them two things: sense of power, of self-confidence, and pride. And this is what brought to life Solidarity 1 year later. It was not his plan, It was the result of his policy of approaching directly and influencing directly people.
So the Americans must have recognized a difference in the approach to Ostpolitik of Paul VI, which was largely diplomatic, a diplomatic level, and that of John Paul II, who saw a diplomatic level pursuit of policy, but also, as you say, can you actually, you know, make that statement for us, that in brief, because it's a very interesting description you just gave us, but in brief, how the American administration saw the difference between Paul VI and John Paul II in their approach to Ostpolitik.
Americans, of course, did realize that what the Pope means to Poles, that he is the greatest authority, and that he, intentionally or unintentionally, is integrating non-communist Poles and giving them the will to act together. That really, in the literal sense, it was the Pope who created solidarity, not in this organizational sense, but in the sense of solidarity of people. And he was the integrating person. And of course, when Poland came, was on the agenda, natural thing was to approach the Pope and to consult him or to advise him, to see to it that he's fully informed, that all the information, and also to be informed about what the Americans are trying to do. And this was the maybe one-way traffic. In my view, there is a lot of sensationalism about the cooperation between the Pope and Americans. The Pope was mainly listening and doing then what he thought one should do. And maybe he was offering some advice. But there was no cooperation in the sense that Vatican would take money from CIA and distribute it to Poland. They had their own money. They had their own funds. And I'm sure that they were trying to support people in need, above all, people who were persecuted. But that's all.
In terms of the finance from the Vatican, are you aware that the Vatican itself, through its bank, actually funded Solidarity and those who were affected by martial law?
No. This is my... I have no first-hand knowledge what the Vatican was really doing. But based on my knowledge, I guess that some funds were going to the church organizations to support people who were persecuted for their views. The problem was that at that time, under influence of the Pope, the church no longer was defending human rights of Catholics. They were defending of human rights of everybody. And therefore, church became a rallying point not for believers only, but for non-believers as well. This was its power. I mean, people who were known for their non-religious views could deliver sermons, literally, in the church. Talk, they couldn't talk outside the church. So the church allowed them to approach the faithful from the pulpit. People who had nothing to do with the church. So this was absolutely the apogeum of the church influence in Poland. And the church became an integrating element, integrating both faithful and non-believers. And this was done, no doubt, under the influence of this Pope, who is very much broad-minded and tolerant, really.
Now, isn't it possible, though, to perceive a picture, to pull together a picture of a very political Pope because of the political impact that he had, particularly in the area and the arena of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union?
I believe that the Pope is very much aware of the border between the heavenly kingdom and the contemporary earthly kingdom. And he is very careful not to cross the line. He is not a political Pope, but he knows how to use the church influence for such purposes, defense of human rights, for instance. And he's very ecumenical Pope. He wants to unite people, and not to unite people by convincing him that they should accept Catholic faith, but the mutual respect for everybody's own religious convictions, so that the people, believers, whether they are Jews or Poles or Protestants, should consider themselves as brothers. This is his idea, but this is an integrating idea. And it became political, whether the Pope wanted it or not. I don't believe that he thinks in terms of political influence and political power, but whatever he does has political effect, and it is a considerable effect.
Can I ask you,
Okay, we'll have a change of tape, actually.
And I say girl, because she was 26, Paula Dobriansky, who was of American, of Ukrainian background. And she had considerable influence, in spite of her young age. I think that she was liked and respected. And I was in almost daily touch with Paula Dobriansky. On the State Department side, it was Mark Palmer, Assistant Deputy Secretary of State for East Central Europe, who played great part, and deputy to Schulz, Whitehead. Schulz was not interested in East Central Europe. He simply picked up a good businessman from New York, Mr. Whitehead, who was put in charge of East Central Europe. And Whitehead even telephoned me at home several times. And he was also a providential person. He had very good grasp of the situation, and he had considerable influence on Reagan in the sense of lifting sanctions gradually and offering carrot and gradually withdrawing stick in exchange for all kind of concessions. And this was the extremely wise policy, formed mainly by advisors who sometimes did have problems with the president, because the president was so much anti-communist that he was hesitating when people were telling him we should lift sanctions. We should never do something that would leave Jaruzelski with nothing to lose. He must have always something to lose and something to gain. And that was the policy. And I must say that in my very modest capacity, I did participate in this formulation of this policy by very close contact with some very brilliant people.
What would Reagan have preferred to do or naturally pursued because of his anti-communism?
Well, there was some tendencies to throw out baby with the bath. In other words, the worse the better. That if we use the sanctions, maybe Jaruzelski would be overthrown or something of that sort. We knew it's totally unrealistic. Sanctions may work, and in the case of Poland, they did work, but only because it was a combination of carrot and stick. If you use stick only, sanctions do not work. But if you offer at the same time a carrot, if you do this, we will lift at least some sanctions. If you do more, we will lift more, and all that. That was the policy used in dealing with Jaruzelski. And I believe also that it was very much along the lines of the Pope, because Pope was also very much concerned that the people should not suffer because of the struggle against the regime. He had this sense, and he had tremendous experience. I will tell you one thing. I was very active since the outbreak of World War II, and as an emissary, I met all important Poles, with the exception of General Sikorski, who died before I reached London, and first commander-in-chief of the Polish underground, who was arrested before. In these 50 years, Poland had two great people. And when I say great, I mean great. One was Wyszyński, the primate of Poland, and second was the Cardinal Wojtyła. And I, before he was elected the Pope, I knew he was a great man. And great in the broadness of his mind, approach to people. And also, he was great because he did not wanted to become a political prelate. He never did. And then I believe he became a great pope. And I strongly believe that without Wojtyła being elected the pope, the developments which occurred between his election and the Solidarity would never happen. And this was a combination of two. First, election of a Pole, which raised the prestige and power of the church and appealed to the pride of people and was something that integrated. But the second was a charismatic influence of the Pope himself, his personality. I think it was a combination of the two. His charisma, his instinctive talent of approaching people and influencing people, and the fact that he was a Polish Pope, that something that had such a tremendous integrating influence on both believers and non-believers. Because even communists were proud when he was elected. They had mixed feelings, at least.
Good point there to finish that line. Let me ask you about what you understood. Well, let me ask you first about Lech Walesa. Did you know
him? I know him well.
What about the role he played, not just in Poland, but his association with Pope John Paul II?
Pope did trust him.
Can you actually name him?
Yeah, okay. Well, there was no doubt a very good relationship between the Pope and Walesa. And Pope, in his own way, did a lot to raise his prestige and his position by being simply very cordial to him, to his wife, who was a very devout Catholic. The way he approached Walesa in public was telling people, I support this man. He is the man whom I trust. And of course, that contributed greatly to the position of the Walesa as a leader, particularly in this immensely difficult period between the martial law and the victory of Solidarity. So the people knew that the Pope is supporting Walesa, that he trusts him, and that he trusts the fact that he is a good Catholic, a believer, consistent in his personal life, in his family life. And Pope knew how to make it evident and obvious to everybody.
It's interesting, that just raises as a side point, that there seems to be in some ways, though, a conflict in or a contradiction in the way in which Pope John Paul II associates himself with the resistance movement in Eastern Europe, yet disassociates and even condemns in Latin America when priests become involved in political movements, and his disassociation from what was going on, what was unfolding in Central Latin America.
My more than guess is he does not support the church getting involved in politics, identifying themselves with the party, any party or any politicians. The Solidarity was much more than this. It was not a political movement. It was a defense of Christian values. And Solidarity, particularly in its first years, was very closely associated with the church. There was a cooperation, but it was not a political party. It was a big movement to restore Christian values in the life of the country against the militant anti-religious policy and ideology of the regime. So it was the fight for Christian values, and the Pope was definitely supporting Solidarity. But he was recently in Poland, and the new Solidarity is now became a party. He didn't say one word of support, one word. He was totally neutral. So he is not supporting Solidarity as a political party right now. Also, I'm sure that he does wish in his heart that the communists do not win election against. But he did not say one word which would be supportive for anybody in the forthcoming election campaign. And nobody can really use any word, he said, except for he's for us. So he's consistent. I think he's consistent.
Was there at any time, I'll go back a little bit, was there at any time that the activity that Radio for Europe, for instance, engaged in supplying material aid to Solidarity, was actually contravening U.S. law in terms of that kind of support?
No, because in the first place, funds were approved by the Congress, and at least some people in the Congress knew exactly how they are going to be used. I don't believe that the law was violated in any way. It was a covert operation, partly. Partly not, partly yes. But it was covert operation with full knowledge and approval of the Congress. And I know that CIA was authorized to conduct covert operation, and it was a very good covert operation. In my view, it was simply a support without any kind of effort to turn Solidarity into an information network, to get information, or to get anything instead. The idea was to support gradual process of expanding freedom. And the United States policy was very consistent in this process.
Can we draw anything from what appears to be a convergence of approach? A historical moment arises in terms of the resistance movement in Poland, and with the election of a Polish Pope who has experienced living under a communist regime, and a president in the form of President Reagan who has strong anti-communist views, his own description of the Soviet Union as the evil empire, that there is a meeting of minds between these two over their experience and stance on communism?
Well, I will tell you the anecdote, which I'm not sure if it's true, but I got it from a pretty good Vatican sources. When the head of state comes to the Pope, they both sit, and the Pope has a prepared statement, which he reads. In the reading of the statement, Reagan had a nap. I've heard it from several sources. So it's very difficult to have a meeting of mind with somebody who is only partly present. And I'm afraid that I have great admiration for President Reagan and his instinct and the role he played. But I doubt if there was really a meeting of mind, if he could not really keep alert himself at the time the head of the Catholic Church was addressing him.
From your experience, though, what was President Reagan's instinct about what was unfolding in Eastern Europe?
Judging by results, fantastic. Reagan had some very strong instinct. And I think his instinct was his good advisor. For instance, the way that he reacted to introduction of martial law was excellent. And again, he was an emotional man. He reacted very strongly when the ambassador of Poland, Spasowski, decided to defect. He, in protest against the martial law, he invited him to the White House with his wife. And Spasowski prepared a 10-point program, 10-point recommendation. And Reagan was really, he did not fall into any nap. He was not only listening attentively, but he said, I will seriously consider all your 10 points, including the last one. And the last one, see the film by Vaida, The Man of Iron. And he immediately arranged the show of the film, invited Spasowski, and was visibly moved. So I believe that to judge on balance the Reagan administration, from the point of view of East Central Europe and Poland, it was excellent on balance. And I think it was because Reagan was, first of all, he had an instinct. Two, he was flexible within some limits. And three, he was listening to advisors. If he trusted the man, he would listen to him. So on balance, from my perspective, Reagan played an extremely constructive role, contributory. I mean, the United States did not decide anything. However, the opposition, I mean, the regime, Urban said, Urban was the spokesman, press spokesman of the government, it would be enough to silence Radio Free Europe for 3 months and solidarity would disappear. And it was true, because it was a communication conveyor belt between underground solidarity and the masses of people. We were the Radio Free Europe was the voice of solidarity, the voice of people. Anybody, the whole country would know what Wałęsa said. Otherwise, nobody would know. So it was true that Radio Free Europe, an instrument which was saved by Reagan, really, and maintained and was given funds, played a tremendous role. So was the fact that publications in Poland, which had a very small circulation, were reprinted in the West with the help of American money and smuggled back to Poland in a considerable amount of copies. So on the whole, I mean, since Carter, the U.S. policy towards Poland and East Central Europe was very I of course know that from the press and now from the documents that particularly Andropov was alarmed by the election of the Pope, that they had realized very well that he may have, even inadvertently, a very disruptive influence on their system in this part of the world. So I'm sure that they considered it a very considerable threat to their control of East Central Europe and particularly to their control of human minds.
Were you ever under any threat from the Soviet Union?
Well, I was the target. I know myself of only one case where there were plans to kidnap me. When I went to Helsinki, which is only very close to Leningrad and now Petersburg, and I was requested by Americans to return instantly, and I couldn't understand why, and when I came back, they told me that it was a problem of my security. And I only guessed that they intercepted some coded messages. And I did have evidence that even in this short time, I was approached by extremely nice Polish Boy Scouts who just came to attend the Helsinki Youth Festival, who were very entertaining, nice, and were all listeners to Radio Free Europe, who said that they came on yacht from Gdynia and they would like me to see the yacht. Well, I'm pretty old hands, so immediately I saw red lights and said, I'm sorry, thank you, I'm too busy, I cannot do it. But I'm sure this was the plan, to lure me to kidnap me, put me on some. Otherwise, I was a target of so-called covert operations, which were forgeries. And it was a masterful work. They were forged all kinds of documents and were collecting the names of my enemies. And of course, the emigre and exile, who was in charge of such a huge organization and had a lot of money at his disposal, was a subject of jealousies. And they had a list of my enemies, and they would place these forgeries in their hands. They would never even bother what is the source, but to distribute it on their own. They would throw this ball. So at the end of my 25 years with Radio Free Europe, I suffered a lot. Through these covert operations, attempts to war nerves against me and my wife, above all, constantly telling her that I would be killed, this kind of things. And it was a concentrated offensive. Well, fortunately, I endured it. But it continued even when I retired from Radio for Europe for some time. I had there were attempts to intimidation against me.
Okay, anything from you, Roland?
Well, I think we've sort of run out of time.
Room for one.
There was also, I think, a difference of objective. You know, the Polish Church was robust enough to be able to subsist as an opposition to the regime.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll turn over for this.
Okay.
Had you turned it off?
Yeah. And if you address your answer, look at me.
Okay.
Yeah.
I believe that Paul VI had such a strong personality and his intellectual capabilities were considerable that I don't think for a moment that he was continuing any policy of his predecessor. He had his own views. And I remember when I talked to Casaroli about Ostpolitik. First of all, I must say that I liked Casaroli very much and had tremendous respect for him, in spite of the fact that I disagreed with the Ostpolitik. However, I mean, he was a good priest, very honest man, and I enjoyed immensely this few conversations that I had with him. But when we started to talk about Ostpolitik, he said, "Mr. Novak, whenever I go to Prague or to Warsaw, I pray that inadvertently I do not make something that would make the position of the church worse and not better. But remember, I am carrying instruction of the Pope. I am not an independent messenger. Ostpolitik is not my policy. It's the policy of the Pope, Paul VI. And I believe he believed in this policy, but that he was honest when he said, I am a messenger. The Pope is the one who does it. Also, he said that don't worry about Poland, because Poland is a special case, and we will rely and support Cardinal Wyszyński and the Polish Episcopate. We are not going to do anything over their heads in a dialogue with the regime. It's a different situation. We will not apply the kind of policy that we pursue vis-à-vis Russia or Czechoslovakia. We will not apply it to Poland. And my last conversation with Casaroli was when Wyszyński reached the age of 75. And according to rules, he should have submitted a resignation, and it was up to the Pope and if he would continue or not. So I went to Casaroli and I said that this is absolutely key position, strategic position, that the unity of church in Poland is in the hands of this man, and I hope he will be he will be extended. He will not be go to retirement. He said, don't worry, he will be extended. But Mr. Novak, don't you realize that behind Cardinal Wyszyński there is an intellect, one of the most outstanding intellect of universal church? After all, Wyszyński will go one day, but you have Wojtyła there. He had no idea that Wojtyła would be a pope. He was simply talking about Wojtyła as a successor to Wyszyński. Clearly remember. But he didn't tell me what I learned later. Wyszyński was extended only until 48, and if not for the death of the Pope, he would be retired in 48, definitely. And also, they wanted to really reduce his special powers. He had, the Polish primate had special ad personam prerogatives, which no other bishop had. And in these last few years, they were trying to take it away from him. And he would simply say, I don't know about it. I will continue as I do because I believe that this is essential for unity of the church. So if not for the fact that the Pope, that Cardinal Wojtyła was elected the Pope and that Paul VI died, that would be the last year of Primate Wyszyński as a Primate of Poland.
Oh, so you meant 78 instead of 48.
78, yeah. Sorry.
Well, I'm just one last
did
thing.
Repeat? No.
I think we're okay for that. Just one last thing, and it is about the difference between Paul VI and John Paul II. And I think, in very brief, it seems to me that what we're talking about is there is a more aggressive line that John Paul II wanted to pursue in relation to Eastern Europe and the situation for the faithful in the Soviet bloc.
The Pope is more aggressive than his predecessor 10 times, but in only evangelical sense of the word. He is the first Pope after St. Paul who decided that he should teach gospel directly to the people in his own person. And he is extremely aggressive in it. I mean, things that he has done during his pontificate, there was more than 10 of his predecessors, in fact. If you look at the new catechism, for instance, the number of encyclicals. I remember when normally I invites me for a talk. It's not an audience, because he knows me well. But once Father Dziwisz said, "Mr. Nowak, he is busy. I cannot really, he cannot talk to you, but tell me whatever you have to say, and I am going to repeat." However, the Pope did come to say hello, and I gave him my book, which was Memoirs of My Years with Radio Free Europe. And he started immediately to look at the photos. And I said, "I know very well, Your Holiness will have no time to read this kind of a book." He said, "Panie Dyrektorze, Mr. Rector, you are wrong. I will read it, because these are the times which are of interest to me." He left, and I asked Father Dziwisz, "For how come that the man who is in charge of this tremendous organization, Universal Church, could find time to read this kind of a book?" He said, "If I wouldn't believe in the Holy Spirit, I wouldn't know how to answer you. But he reads one page, 15 seconds, and he will tell you everything that is there." I mean, he writes so fast that his hand faints, because his thoughts are much faster than his writing. So this is the man of absolutely exceptional qualities, of both intellect and character. But he's not a political pope. He's not aggressive in a political sense of the word. And he makes his own mind. I mean, General Jaruzelski was a very bad symbol in Poland after he introduced the martial law. And there was some pressure from Paul on the Pope that he should refuse to see him. "No, I'm going to see anybody. If the head of state, whether he's a communist or not, wants to see me, I will see him. It's an opportunity to tell him what I want to tell him." He did see the Jaruzelski. He didn't mind that it would have adverse impact on some people who thought that, well, he is the man who is a butcher of solidarity. No, he will see him. So it's always double-track policy.
And cut.
Right.
We'll have to.